Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.
Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
And I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, the podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are here for a historic confrontation.
And on today's podcast, we'll start with a little combat. I want to tell you about an event Robert and I did recently right here in WNYC's new green space. We built a little boxing ring with ropes and everything.
No love gloves.
We asked Ira Glass, who you're hearing to be our boxing referee. About 250 people showed up.
Tap gloves.
And Robert and I decided to go head
to
head.
To settle once and for all the debate, radio versus television. Which is superior? So let's get started. In this corner, Robert, the Crusher, Krulwich!
I got to wear a blue silk kind of boxing gig.
In the opposite corner, the one, the only, Jad Boom Boom Abumrad. Ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together.
And I got to wear the very stylish red boxing trunks.
With a hood?
With a hood and yeah. Real boxing gloves. So here's how it went. We went 5 rounds. The rules are pretty simple. I'd play something, then Robert would play something, and then Ira and the audience would judge. Round one,
question,
topic was...
Which is better at pictures, radio or television?
We'll just jump to the results just to give you a taste.
Okay.
All right. Television is the winner. Round two. Which medium is better at emotions? Is it radio? Or is it television?
Oh. So after 2 rounds, we were tied, and so let's just speed things up here. We went 3 more rounds over 3 various questions, and when we got to round 5, which was on the question of which is more fun, radio or TV, well, here's what happened.
I declare television the winner.
No!
Oh,
no!
There was more sound.
Riot!
Do you want to have a recount? We can do a recount.
I want them to riot.
You're familiar with the concept of sore loser, right? Radio doesn't have to win. How much more dignity is there to this whole event?
But we're in a radio station, Ira. We have to win. If we can't win here, we can't win anywhere.
All right, I'll take the poll again. Radio.
Come on!
I suddenly realized why they don't do recounts in elections. And television! Oh, come on! You guys are saying tie?
It was a draw.
It was a draw.
I mean,
everybody won that night, Jad.
No.
Radio and
no,
TV.
No, I doing. Still refuse to believe.
So then we decided, well, okay, so...
We took off our robes and our gloves.
Yeah. And then we sat down and say, well, let's just put it all together here. Like, there are rules for making TV. There are rules for making radio. And how are they different? And Ira began.
All the rules of what we do on the radio, especially on our show, where the stories have narrative motion, where there's characters in motion and there's a conflict that announces itself pretty quickly, and the people have to be pretty, somebody has to be pretty charming and you can relate to. It's like our show on the radio pretends to be a show where we're documenting everyday life, but we're not actually. What we're doing is we're getting sort of regular people who are in really, really unusual and interesting situations that would be worth putting on the radio. And the thing that having pictures let us do was to actually eliminate the need for a surprising plot line and could let us just have moments that we knew would be dramatic, like a guy's kid comes home from the army, comes home from Iraq, and you know, like we had specific moments we were going out to shoot, but they didn't have to surprise in exactly the same way. And really a lot of the thing is kind of staring at people in a way that just is just anti-radio. Like it was an entire hour that just would have been very difficult to do on radio. A lot of what we did on TV, I think you could have done on radio. There's like a hugeness to the radio, to the intimacy of the radio. Like when you're in the actual cruddy little hospital room in a not so fancy hospital in Washington State, and it's a real guy and his sort of semi-photogenic mom, and he's like a little bit of a stiff, and she, I don't know, like, and then they perform the scene, and you see them. Really, they're not iconic, weirdly, like something about the specifics of staring at them and of that room, and you recognize kind of the hospital tray. It just plays really differently. Whereas on radio, it would be weirdly mythic. If you think about that piece that you played where it's the dad and the kid, there's something really epic about it. Like it's intimate and it's epic because he like with his deep voice and her sort of symbolic like kidness become iconic.
Ira's talking about a piece which had an unfairly cute daughter growing up.
Why don't we just play it for them?
Father with a really deep voice.
This was, totally I think we played it in round two. This is from John Bewin.
At first, it's physical, like any great love. Those eyes, those hands, those thighs.
Really?
Hey Harper, what's a kitty cat say? The weight of them on your lap, climbing on your head. Nobody writes pop songs about that touch, that feeling.
What you going to listen about?
I'm going to listen to you. Ooh. But riding around inside that little body, there's this person.
Over here?
A budding mind. He'll do anything to touch.
Here you go. I made this for you. That special coffee.
So this small body becomes the source of your biggest fears. The child's flesh is vulnerable. So you are too.
Do you see the black berries on this tree?
I do.
But my favorite part of that school is going outside. It's paradise.
You all look wonderful in your outfits, Mrs. said. I can't wait to learn what all of you want to be when you grow up.
Can I have some milk?
How old are you now, girl?
8.
Hi, Daddy.
I'm scared.
But you have to let go. Let her go, little by little.
Lindsay said that Kayla said something mean about me. She said not to tell Kayla.
In that way, too. In that way in which her body was never for you.
Next message.
Hi, Daddy. It's Harper. We're going to be out, like, on a GAL girls afternoon out. Just call me on my cell phone. Like, if anything happens or anything, I'll call you whenever I come home. Okay, bye.
So, girl, how old are you going to be your next birthday?
13.
And have you and your mama talked about, you know, the talk?
Yeah.
Do you think you and I should have the talk?
No. No. No.
Good.
So that was a piece called Scared from John Bewin. Thanks to him and to Harper Bewin and to the Third Coast Audio Festival. And now back to the event.
I mean, one of the deep differences is when you watch the TV, it is an act of staring. So you're in a chair or standing, and you're looking across a space at a box with a square, and then in the square are some images, and you, your options are to look away or to look at it. You also know that between you and it, there could be lots of business. Someone could come by, a cat could go by, a child could go by, a dog could go by, or something could catch your eye and you'd flick it away. So there is a stare in TV. In the radio, often people either clamp something on either ear, or if they don't do that and they're just listening to the radio, there is an intimate kind of sharing where if the radio is describing, the person listening starts to paint involuntarily just because they helplessly picture the words you're saying. And the painting in your head, first of all, belongs to you, and it's not a stare. It's actually very unlike a stare. And there's more, when you are co-authoring, which is what you're doing, the story you're being told, there is more room in there for that story, in a way. Mm-hmm. But when you stare, you do get to see things that you wouldn't know, that you wouldn't find yourself, that mm-hmm. you couldn't imagine. But there is a coolness to the stare and a warmness to the radio that just travels, and there are advantages and disadvantages to both. And
I see all that and felt all that when we were making TV. Like the other thing that always struck me as a huge difference is that to get an emotional moment on TV, like we could make an emotional moment, and just like you say, you have people's faces and they communicate so much and communicate just as much as the voice does. But to make an emotional moment on TV, it's almost like we would have to like erect a scaffolding for it to happen and build to the moment. And there'd have to be like fast action, fast action, fast action, cutting, 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 and then we'd have to slow it down. So you could feel the slowness. And then there could be slower sorts of emotion and feeling, and the music would change. And it was sort of like a much bigger orchestration job in the way it had to be photographed and handled. Whereas on radio, it has such emotion as the default position. Like it's the thing that it's going to do when it's not even trying to do anything, is communicate a lot of feeling and a lot of intimacy. You know, like we can send out anybody with a tape recorder, and if they can talk to somebody, they'll get that. And the sound of the person's voice will carry all this feeling. And that seemed to me just a huge difference. And then people were more able to open up on the radio, too, like was sort of an ancillary thing, when it isn't like a camera crew and lights, and like, you know, we were shooting very pretty, so it was a lot of people. And by the time we finished our second season, like when we started our first season, I thought, well, we'll get the same percentage of people who open up on radio and TV. But by the time we got to the end of the second season, Lisa and Nancy and the other producers, when they really wanted to get down with people, we would film part of the interview, and then they would just tape part of the interview. They would just take the person off, and they would tape part of the interview just with a tape recorder, just them.
Really?
Yeah. And then we would use that part and the part where you see pictures of other stuff. So we totally tricked it out to get the kinds of quotes that we wanted, because we weren't getting the quotes we wanted while the camera was rolling sometimes.
Let me ask you both a question. Since you both have done radio and TV, in many cases the same story on radio and TV, how is the experience of doing radio, being behind the camera, different than being behind the microphone? Because I always sort of joke with him. I have this experience. Every time I see him on TV, it tweaks me. It's weird. Because I'm like, who is that guy? He's not the Robert that I know from the studio, because he's the Robert in the studio and the Robert like in this ring. And I love the fact that we're having this quiet chat in a boxing ring, by the way. He's kind of like this oversized, outsized, emotional dude. He's like just huge gestures. But on TV, it's all like he keeps it small. He kind of brings it in. And there's something about the scale that is really interesting to me when you see somebody do both. You know, I mean, I wonder.
He's like, always said this. He says, when you know, he just says, it's so little, you're so tight, you're so... you learn, here's the thing, the camera goes and looks right at you, and so if you were to give a big Cheshire Cat grin, if you were to make a broad gesture in the box, it's just too big. So you just learn somewhere along the line that that you do scale it down because you're so big in this virtual space.
But you're bigger on the radio? Because I always say, I tell people, like, when you're performing on the radio, it's like you're in front of a camera and the camera's always on close up. And, like, you use your inside voice, you know? Kind of.
Well, like, you had to get the desk.
Yeah,
right?
Why the desk?
The desk thing.
Well, that was just in the first season. I mean, the conceit of it was we couldn't figure out how to put me on TV. Like where should I be? Or should I even be? Should you ever see me at all? And then it seemed kind of artsy that you would never see me. You know what I mean? My favorite version of the different ways that you would see me would be that I would walk into each story at the end like Rod Serling and go, a man and a woman. You know, but I feel like I could perform that too.
But was it a scale thing? Was it that you needed to feel somehow?
No. We did the desk because we just thought, like, after trying to run it, we shot all sorts of different things as little tests, and all of them trying to run away from the conventions of a host on TV. But truthfully, like, everything's been done if you're a host on TV. Like, you know, your own real desk, that's been done. You in a car just talking to the camera. You walking down the street with the subject. You just, like, every sort of casual and non-casual version has been done. And so we thought, well, let's, instead of running away from the conventions, let's run towards them. Let's take the corniest convention and let's do the desk and the suit and the mug and, like, a microphone, and let's build one of those desks that only exist on television, that doesn't exist in nature, that's like one of those shiny desks. And then let's put it outside. Let's just put it somewhere random. I had never seen the, there's apparently a Monty Python thing where the Anchorman is outside. I didn't know that. You see, even that had been done. But so we would just take it to incredibly, like, the idea is, like, one day it's in a factory floor and the next day it's by a nuclear power station, and, you know, and so that was the idea. It was just, let's make something big and photographic.
But why the trouble? You said you couldn't figure out how to be on TV, because, like, with This American Life, like, it's so identical. It has that, like, weirdly just, it's imprinting a kind of intimacy on,
right,
so many
and
people.
I know, and it's something weirdly anti-intimate about the image that we ended up making with me in it. And in the second season, because of that, instead of shooting it that way, we bought a little flip camera for $149 at Best Buy, and we shot all the things of me with that. We'd just go on the subway, and I would just shoot myself talking to the camera and saying my thing.
What about the audience? I sense that the radio audience is a completely different audience in a consistently different mood than the television audience.
What do you think?
I mean, I do.
Like, as in different people or different when they're
a
in front
different
of the TV
people.
Versus...
But commercial television tends to get a slightly older group, and radio, at least this radio, that Miss American Life and Radio Life does this, gets a bit of a younger audience. But beyond that, I think the radio audience gets the impression that they know you, and the TV audience, because of the staring, they will respect you, they'll do, yo, saw you on TV thing, that is, they'll notice you, they don't presume to begin or have a conversation with you, whereas on the radio, they presume to have a conversation with you. So
you're saying from your experience being on NPR and being on ABC?
Yeah.
You know where we see it, actually, we sort of see the flip side of that, is when we take over Terry Gross's spot, Fridays at 3, which we do a couple times a year, you would not believe the vitriol, the venomous
Get them
explosion
off. Who are they?
Of hatred, as if we have kidnapped Terry, literally kidnapped her, and taken and locked her into the closet. There, Terry Gross. You know, so it's
but Friday's her rerun show. They've heard it already.
It doesn't matter. It's part of their routine. On Fridays at 3, what do? I do her. And who are these two people? And what are they doing? No! They don't listen to it. They just, like, they bite it.
I have to say, like the biggest thing I've ever done on TV was just 2 weeks ago, and that is that I appeared on the Colbert Report. Yeah. And I'd been on The Daily Show, I'd been on Letterman, I'd been on Conan. But there's something about people's relationship to Stephen Colbert where, like, complete strangers walk up to me on the street and call out to me on the street, and, like, a lot of them, and it's like, hey, saw you on Colbert. They feel like it was us against him or something. Like, they have such a, like, they're like they just want me to know, like, they watch Colbert and they were with me, you know, and it was
with you because you survived Colbert, or with you because you're part of the Colbert Club?
Both. like, I survived it. They're like, hey, you did okay, sort of, with Colbert. You know, like, it very much was like, it was like I was in a boxing match with Stephen Colbert, and they appreciated it, and they want to tell me about it, like, in a way that I found really lovely.
Well, then that's maybe our last question, is the glamour question. There is, has been for years associated with being on TV, there's this sense of, ooh, wow, kind of thing. And then radio was sort of the other thing you could do if you were in a car and or cutting carrots. And I get the sense that that's actually switched a bit. So Steve Colbert could almost have, has a radio-y, I don't know why I say this, but Steve Colbert, who does wonderful sight gags, and you know, but there is something about that show, even more than the other one, that does seem like, I don't know why, seems like the best radio that I hear.
These people have such a personal relationship with him in a way that I don't know. I mean, I feel that way about a handful of shows. You know, I feel that way about the drama. You know, I feel that way about Friday Night Lights. You know,
the greatest show on television,
except for the second season.
Except for The Wire.
Say the second season was a downer.
The Wire.
It's true.
I mean, they're good. They're good. I mean, I guess I'm saying like, I feel that about other things on television besides Stephen Colbert. I think that's the bond you feel with any show that you really love. You feel like
I was in the subway and I saw an inspector from The Wire, that really mean guy, the Polish guy who wants to buy the, Valchek. I saw the actor who plays Valchek, and he was sitting there and I was holding the pole, and I thought I guess I'll honor him by my quiet gaze. I won't say anything, you know, and my heart was beating and everything. I was thinking I was going to tell my wife. I said, guess who I saw on the subway? So, but I didn't. If I'd seen Stephen Colbert, or if I didn't know you and saw you, I think I'd.
he says with disdain.
I think I'd find it more approachable. I think I might dare. I might say, oh hi. Or something like that.
Yeah, it's true.
Well, that's because on the radio, if you're performing it right, you're exactly human size. Like if you're on the radio, if you're doing it correctly, I think there's a one-to-one scale.
But you said earlier, though, that it was mythic and epic, too, though.
That moment in that story. Yeah, no, that's true. I guess it's a contradiction.
I think one of the things that This American Life did was they made true stories feel like fairy tales. Like and it has to do with the music, it has to do with the way they're constructed and with the surprise and the characters that you meet. It feels like a fairy tale. It feels like you're entering
the world. You mean on TV and on radio?
I mean mostly on the radio. I'm thinking sort of early, you know, just that show coming out of everything else that was at that time. Suddenly these characters did seem large. They seemed like sort of epic and huge, and but yet sort of like embedded in their breasts the same sort of desires and fascinations and fears that the rest of us had. So that was new for me to hear that. So I don't know. I mean, it gets confusing when you use the techniques of fiction storytelling, the techniques of movie making with true stories. You can invest true reality with a sense of largeness and a sense of sweep that you would only expect to see like in a movie theater. That's kind of the cool thing about it, I think.
And then there's The Wire. Thank you all for coming.
Thanks for coming out.
Okay, that's how the event ended. We want to thank Carrie Hillman for helping us produce the event. Definitely want to thank the Green Space people for making that very cool space available.
Green Space means the part of the building at WNYC.
Yeah,
you can now
new
have
space.
Live events, which is where that was. So it just was inaugurated that very week, so that was our inaugural, maybe do more of those. And also to the Hungry Marching Band, because they made a lot of big, loud, noisy music.
Yes, thanks. And also we want to thank the people that helped make Radiolab possible. That would be, number one,
Sloan.
Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. Number two,
Mr. Corporation.
For Public Broadcasting. And number three,
Mr. National Science.
Yes.
Who has a foundation.
Yeah, them. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.